The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Kalayla Williams, and I'm the Director of Neighborhood Library Enrichment Programming here at the Free Library. I'm pleased to introduce Dr. Imani Perry tonight to talk about her new book, Looking for Lorraine, The Radiant and Radical Life of Lorraine Hansberry. So tonight's program falls on a very auspicious night because it's also National Voter Registration Day, as many of you know. And so I encourage you to register to vote at your current address before October 9th and to mark your calendars, of course, for November 6th, which is Election Day. Midterms matter more than ever, and so we need all communities turning out at the polls. Tonight's reader, Imani Perry, is the Hughes Rogers Professor of African American Studies, as well as the Faculty Associate in the Program in Law and Public Affairs and Gender and Sexuality Studies at Princeton University. Drawing from a diversity of fields such as law, literary and cultural studies, music, and the social sciences, Perry has researched and written about relevant issues affecting African American communities and the world at large. Her previous books include More Beautiful and More Terrible, The Embrace and Transcendence of Racial Inequality in the United States and Prophets of the Hood, Politics and Poetics in Hip Hop, and May We Forever Stand, A History of the Black National Anthem. In addition to Looking for Lorraine, readers can also look forward to another new publication, Vexy Thing, on gender and liberation, which is expected later in September, or later in 2018. A recipient of a bachelor's degree from Yale University and a JD and PhD on the history of American civilization from Harvard University, Perry's books, as well as the numerous articles she has published, have pushed forward vital insight around conversations that are as complex and uneasy as they are necessary. Everyone, please welcome Dr. Imani Perry.
Good evening. It's wonderful to be here. I am a Philadelphia transplant. I have fallen in love with this city. So it's really precious for me to be at one of the most important institutions in the city. And I'd also add that a raisin in the sun, Philadelphia is one of the cities that was a tryout location for A Raisin in the Sun, so it's also one of the places that was important for Lorraine Hansberry early in her career, and so it's wonderful to be here. I'm going to read from two different sections, one, the introduction to the book, and then I'll talk a little bit about the second section before going into it. And from the introduction, the part I'm going to read is really just about sort of what brought me to the book. What I'm looking for in the pages is something of my past and Lorraine's legacy. The exercise is bizarre and exquisite. Writing about her now, many years past my childhood encounters, is a temporal oddity. She died at 34. I am 44 as I write these words. I will always be older than she ever was. She was born in 1930. I was born in 1972. She will always be generations ahead of me. As a woman of my generation, I look to her to understand the historic past and the bloom of lost youth at the same time. I want to honor her labors. I was always given the impression that because Lorraine died so young, so much of what she was supposed to do was left undone. But the archive, appropriately housed at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture in Harlem, tells a different story, the one that journalist Izzy Rowe shared at her death. Though she lived but a few years in the full bloom of womanhood, she accomplished the full measure of living and left behind an immortality which will live out the lifespan of even generations yet to be born. so much is done. And from it, my story of her has emerged, the story of an artist and an intellectual of a particular sort, no less passionate than she was probing, but consistently both. It is a story that disrupts her obscurity and the manner in which she has remained hidden in plain sight, not simply with expanded details of her life, but as a portrait of the artist. This is more like a composition than an archaeological dig, though a great deal of digging through thousands of pages was involved. I try to catch a likeness of her, the urgency with which she lived, especially in her final days, when she was literally running out of time, was infused with a sense of the possible, peace, justice, love, beauty. She believed they could all be achieved and that we ought to reach for them. And so, in these complicated times, not only a time in which she were alive or reincarnated, she could be an out lesbian and loudly unconflicted about her myriad identities, but also a period in which her impolitic and incisive tongue would likely have prevented her from a good deal of recognition, I think she has something to teach us. The portrait here is then as much homage to her as it is gift to myself and to you, that we might see the stuff of our lives in hers. So much is yet to be done, and she can help us do it. Time insists in a multitude of forms. The urgency of her time and its particularities must be understood within the deep sense of possibility that she maintained, a sense that characterizes youth in general, and in particular those for whom justice-seeking is their life work. We are running out of time. The earth is ravaged. Our bodies are indefinite. Lorraine reminds us to make use of each moment. The book is then also a portrait of the artist as a woman at that crossroads, ahead of her time. Lorraine's witness and wisdom help us understand the world, its problems and its possibilities. In her lonely reckonings, her impassioned reaching for justice, and the seriousness of her craft, she teaches us how to more ethically, more lovingly witness one another today. There is something quieter but no less important, too. In these pages, I want to catch a likeness of her to give a reader a sense of the sweet and intimate parts of her, what made her smile and raised her ire, what drove her passions, and how she loved. Now, Lorraine Hansberry was born in Chicago, the child of migrants from the Deep South. Her father was a native of Amit, Mississippi. Her mother was a native of Tennessee. She was raised in a middle-class family. Her father was a real estate mogul, but raised on the south side of Chicago, which was an area that was profoundly segregated and subject. It was a sort of, Chicago was the a location of great hope for migrants from the Deep South, but also I describe it as a place of the dream and also its deferral, in that many of the hopes of migrants from the Deep South were not fully actualized. And as a high school student, her father actually, after years of engaging in civil rights activism, aspiring to open up segregated housing in Chicago, ultimately kept finding himself frustrated in the goal of creating more opportunity for Black Chicagoans, and so decided to move the family to Mexico, and actually died of a brain aneurysm in Mexico when she was a sophomore in high school. Lorraine, upon graduating from high school, decided to attend the University of Wisconsin. She integrated a dormitory there, and then she wound up dropping out. She was not, one of the things that I actually love about her is that she was not particularly academic, though she was brilliant, and I find that to be a useful lesson for us these days, that sometimes she got a D in drama as a high school student. So that should let us know something. And then she went to New York, and I'm going to read from the section for when she first arrives in New York. Harlem was New York's equivalent of the South Side of Chicago, but Lorraine didn't start there. She moved downtown to Greenwich Village, and she took another stab at college, enrolling in courses in jewelry making, photography, short story writing, and the history of American civilization at the New School for Social Research. That lasted for about 2 erratic months before she dropped out again, but she stuck with New York. Lorraine was among the thousands of pilgrims to the village. Poets and painters alike were drawn to Manhattan's downtown. Artistic movements that are now counted among the most important of the 20th century, beat poets, abstract expressionists, folk music, were all growing there. The art blooming out of gatherings of scruffy young creators. They hung out in bars and coffee shops. They had house parties and lived in lofts. And the more politically minded among them handed out mimeographed leaflets and went to rallies. New York University and New School students blended in with dropouts. Knowledge and experimentation circulated wildly. The village became a place that was open to gay and lesbian people and had more interracial socializing than almost anywhere else in the United States. That fall, Lorraine had her first publication. She was finally an artist. It was a poem in the leftist magazine, Masses and Mainstream, titled Flag from a Kitchenette Window. It read, Southside morning, America's crying. In our land, the paycheck taxes to somebody's government. Black boy in a window, Algiers and Salerno. The three colored banner raised to some anonymous freedom. We decide and on the Memorial Day hang it from our windows and let it beat the steamy Jim Crow airs. The poem was a sparse indictment of American militarism and hypocritical proclamations of liberty in the face of Jim Crow, an ironic commentary on Memorial Day. It was also a work that was clearly influenced by a distinguished Chicago black woman poet, Gwendolyn Brooks. Brooks's Kitchenette Building had been published in her 1945 book, A Street in Bronzeville, at a time when Lorraine was still in high school. While Hansberry's poem faces outward, Brooks, always a master of the interior, attended carefully to the feelings, senses, and space inside the kitchenette apartments of Chicago. She wrote, "We are things of dry hours and the involuntary plan, grayed in and gray. Dream makes a giddy sound, not strong like rent, feeding a wife, satisfying a man. But could a dream send up through onion fumes its white and violet fight with fried potatoes and yesterday's garbage ripening in the hall?" Lorraine was not a master yet. Her poem paled in comparison to Brooks, but she tried to do something like her fellow Chicagoan, yet also distinct. The daughter of the kitchenette king, her father was a real estate entrepreneur, Lorraine wanted to present the lives of her father's residents. People oppressed and exploited, offset against the national lies of liberty and democracy. She was political, but she was also an aesthete. Her words were chosen with care for their sound and their rhythm. She had begun to step into herself and into a raucous public. The primary gathering spot in Greenwich Village was Washington Square Park. Named after George Washington, its arch bears one of his quotations. Let us raise a standard to which the wise and the honest can repair. The event is in the hand of God. Though they were the very opposite of a stodgy memorial to the father of the country, these iconoclastic young people took his words fully to heart. Their honesty was a collective event, often sung out in the square, accompanied by guitars, banjos, and mandolins. Lorraine found plenty of other young artists, plenty of passionate conversationalists, plenty of unsure seekers in the village, and yet she was still one of just a smattering of black women. And she was a Chicagoan. Early on in her New York days, she reflected on her home. Lorraine had come from the big city at the center of the country, but in contrast, Chicago must have seemed awfully small and simple. One of her diary entries from her first year in New York has a tinge of nostalgia for her home and more than a little desire to keep capturing it artistically. I remember the winters that have come before in my life, these same colored days when I could smell the paint of hot radiators with sleep in my eyes, when sometimes there was the dirty feeling of being in the thick wool smelling clothes of the school morning. And the times they say were happy times, times that were not but were, bitter, bitter times for the young soul, always the same cold days I thought were kind because they made others my brothers. In the same note, she goes from the bittersweet sense of connection to others in Chicago to the deep loneliness she felt in Wisconsin. A gray world I did terribly love through the awful hurt. Narrow black trees somewhere, fighting with the sky and always the grayness, moving lonely. Wonderful rhythms just for me. Others would be there, football crowds of laughters. It is worse because I cannot hate them now. Only they say I must not love my grayness now. How can they know? And then she went back to yearning. I want to be inside, on a floor, near a piano, near a leg that must press against my side or my shoulder or my breast so that I can feel the music in the roots of my eyes and then let my grayness come. She was depressed but also hopeful. That was quintessentially Lorraine. Even in the saddest moments, she reached for something, usually intimacy. She had excitement, but she yearned for closeness and connection, something still elusive in the throngs of other seekers. Years later, a friend reflected, many times when I watched her unguarded moments, her thoughts were beyond the second of which she was a part. I could see that there was an extra special kind of human being, one who seemed ordained for something beyond the everyday scheme of things. Sometimes I even thought to be unfriendly, antisocial, a girl who should have been born tomorrow instead of some yesterday. Notwithstanding her passion and playfulness, Lorraine had a melancholic disposition. But she also had a sense of mission, and perhaps was grateful that it could distract her. But this mission also seems to have been at least as powerful as her intimate yearnings. In 1951, Lorraine moved uptown to Harlem to fulfill it and to be with her people. She attended tenant strikes and civil rights protests. She lectured about racial and economic justice at the famous Speaker's Corner at 135th Street in Lenox. And she took a job. In a letter to her friend Edith, she wrote, I'm living in New York now, since last November, and I can't remember what I wrote you last or how much I told you when I did write. Probably a lot of nonsense about Greenwich Village and that business. Fact is, I have finally stopped going to school and started working, which means a lot of things. I work for the new Negro paper, Freedom, which in its time in history ought to be the journal of Negro liberation. In fact, it will be. Freedom was the brainchild of the leftist actor and singer Paul Robeson. Robeson was the publisher and the editor of the weekly paper was Louis Burnham, a Harlem native who had been active in the American Student Movement and the Young Communist League. In his youth, Burnham had also organized the first chapters of the American Student Union on black college campuses and served as youth secretary of the Communist-affiliated National Negro Congress and also as the executive secretary of the Southern Negro Youth Congress. 15 years her senior, though still quite young, he was a key figure in the black leftist community. He welcomed Lorraine into the Freedom Digs. The humble office overlooked Lenox Avenue. There were two desks, one typewriter, Lewis and Lorraine, and not much else. The resources were limited. Their operations were meagerly funded by the Committee for the Negro and Arts. Lorraine earned a take-home pay of $31.70 a week, which she noted wryly kept her lean. But the lessons were abundant. Louis Burnham became a close mentor of hers and referred to her as, quote, the girl who could do everything. He quickly moved Lorraine from clerical to editorial and writing work. She learned as she labored. Freedom provided its readers with incisive articles about global anti-colonialist struggles and domestic activism against Jim Crow. It shared a clear feminist message with stories about women's activism and images of women to represent activist movements. The paper also included television, film, and book reviews, children's stories about black history, for adults, fiction with political messages, and Robeson editorials. The general manager, George B. Murphy, scion of the family that founded the Baltimore Afro-American newspaper, who, like Lorraine, had gone from bourgeois to communist, worked diligently to ensure the paper's distribution. It became a home of sorts and ground for immense growth. At least three of her writings for Freedom show how Lorraine was thinking about art during that period. She chillingly dismissed Richard Wright's The Outsider. He exalts brutality and nothingness. He negates the reality of our struggle for freedom and yet works energetically on behalf of our oppressors. He has lost his own dignity and destroyed his talents. In her review of Howard Fast's novel Spartacus, she questioned whether his depiction of the freedom-fighting figure of Spartacus could have been better made if he had written through the eyes of the enslaved rather than the slaveholders, who she referred to as a degenerate class. In her review of the Japanese film Hiroshima, she argued against the dismissive critiques of the film, calling them vulgar for their short-sightedness. Hiroshima, as she opined, both great propaganda and great art. In calling it both art and propaganda, she echoed the sentiments of her Uncle Leo's mentor and her newly adopted mentor, W.E.B. Du Bois, in the 1926 essay, Criteria of Negro Art. He argued that all art is propaganda and should be intentionally so for those advocating racial justice. Likewise, her critique of Black subjects on television indicated that she was concerned with the question of representation of Blacks in media, an issue that had been taken up by another family friend, Walter White, when he served on the Hollywood Bureau of the NAACP in the 1940s. Lorraine also wrote about international politics. In a December 1951 issue of Freedom, she covered Kwame Nkrumah, who had been her uncle's student at Howard University. Her uncle was a professor of African studies, of the People's Party in Ghana, and his election as the first prime minister of the Gold Coast since the Portuguese first established it as a slave trading post in the early 1500s. In this article, Lorraine connected the struggle for Ghanaian independence to the one for racial justice in the United States, saying, "The people of Ghana clearly see their struggles and victories in connection with Black folk on the rest of their continent, as well as in the United States." A U.S. Negro reporter for the Pittsburgh Courier commented not long ago, "Whenever I make an interview in Accra, it is a two-sided affair. I ask questions about events in the Gold Coast, and they ply me with questions about the Willie McGee case, the Cicero, Illinois race riot, Dr. Ralph Bunche, and topics American Negroes are discussing today." She similarly noted that Black Americans admired Ghanaian independence, a transformation that was visually marked by the transition in Ghana from European business suits to traditional draped robes. She also wrote about liberation struggles in Egypt, delinquency and child labor at home, and women's activism in the case of Willie McGee, a Black man who had been falsely charged with the rape of a white woman and who had been given a death sentence. In covering that case, Lorraine traveled with other activists to her father's home state of Mississippi to organize and advocate on McGee's behalf. Afterward, his electrocution haunted her pen. For Lorraine, Black freedom and the prospect of a society free of capitalism were intertwined, and this was partially a result of the influence of mentors like Paul Robeson, W.E.B. Du Bois, and Louis Burnham, but it was also the result of her studies. She believed that the exploitation of people, labor, and land by the wealthy, while most of the world suffered, was fundamentally unjust. The only redeeming organization of society, as far as she was concerned, would be one of commonwealth and common good. Lorraine's writings for Freedom were political and critical, not creative. Although she didn't write poetry or fiction for Freedom, Burnham encouraged her creative aspirations. She once confided in him, "I was desperately worried about having become too jaded at 20 to retain all the lovely things I had wanted to say in my novel when I was 18. It was part of his genius as a human being that he did not laugh or patronize my dilemma, but went on gently and seriously to prod me to consider the possibilities of the remaining time of my life." And she did pursue her art. In July of 1951, she had another poem published in Masses and Mainstream titled Lynch Song in honor of Rosalie Ingram, who along with her two sons had been given a death sentence for killing a white man who had tried to rape her. Lorraine wrote, See the eyes of Willie McGee. My mother told me about lynchings. My mother told me about the dark nights and dirt roads and torch lights and lynch robes. As was often the case, Lorraine referenced her mother's lessons earned in the segregated South, but also characteristically for Lorraine, she reminded readers that this phenomenon, the violence of racism, was a national rather than a regional phenomenon, and both extra-legal lynch law and Jim Crow courts, which were as common up north as down home, were unjust. The poem continued, "White robes and black robes and a burning, burning cross, cross in Laurel, cross in Jackson, cross in Chicago, and a cross in front of the city hall in New York City." Consistent with the messages in her poetry, Lorraine lived her life in New York as an activist. She was often on picket lines and at protests and worked at local campaigns for the American Labor Party and the People's Rights Party. Rather than dedicating herself to one organization, she moved about in various leftist groups, including being both a student and an instructor at the Jefferson School for Social Science. As a frequent participant in the Jefferson School Sunday forums, Lorraine spent time with W.E.B. Du Bois, perhaps the greatest scholar of the 20th century. Du Bois had years prior recognized her Uncle Leo's talent when he was an undergraduate at Atlanta University and arranged for him to study at Harvard. Likewise, he recognized Lorraine's gifts, and according to his wife, she became his favorite student, one whom he believed was gifted enough to teach others as well as study under his tutelage. Among the assignments she completed for him in a 1953 course on Africa was the Belgian Congo, a preliminary report on its land, its history, and its people, a paper that traced the politics, economics, and social arrangements of its pre-colonial and colonial history. After she completed the course, Lorraine held on to the copious notes on Algeria, Egypt, and French West Africa and referenced them in her future writing. Du Bois was a heroic figure in black life, and particularly for the black left. For a young black intellectual, studying him with him was the very height of apprenticeship. Lorraine captured that extraordinary feeling in verse-like lines she wrote to herself on May 8, 1953 in her class notebook. "Imagine then what it is for me, a young Negro, sprung from all the unrest and fervent searching and anxiety, his back against the sunlight of May afternoons, blue suit, lined shirt, bow tie, pince-nez, goatee and mustache, relaxing back leisurely, full and confident in his vast knowledge and his splendid sense of interpretation of history, his voice coming always perfectly measured, his upper lip curling now and again in appreciation of his wit, freedom's passion, refined and organized, sits there." And I thought it was nice to end with her appreciation of the past, because so much of the book is really sort of trying to appreciate her as a figure from the past with something to bring something to bear on the present, and she always did that with those who mentored her. So if there are questions or comments, good evening.
It's nice to see you and hear your voice. I like your writing. Your writing reinforced the blackness. What was the relation between Lorraine Hansberry and the NLCP? Any rift or solidarity with them?
With the CP, you said?
NAACP.
NAACP. Oh, okay, yes. So what's interesting is that, so her father and mother were both active in the NAACP. By the time she became an adult, partially, and you have to think about it, she was mentored by W.E.B. Du Bois, who by that point had been put out of the NAACP because his politics were far to the left of where the NAACP was at that time period. And you know, the NAACP, in some ways, in its efforts to align its, you know, in its efforts to impact federal policy around segregation really stepped back from anti-colonialist struggles internationally, and also sort of pushed aside its more socialist members. And so she was critical of the NAACP, but I say that also wanting to be sort of cautious. It was such an integral part of her life. I mean, she was, you know, connected to it for the entirety of her life, so that while her politics were to the left of it, it wasn't as though, you know, she was it was an alien organization to her. It was actually very it was central, and particularly around her father worked, when she was a little girl, a case that her father brought that was a sort of housing segregation case, actually made it all the way to the Supreme Court in 1940, called Hansberry v. Lee, and it's a case that he actually entered with attorneys from the NAACP, and she they moved into a white neighborhood, they were put out of the neighborhood because the neighborhood was covered by a racially restrictive covenant that didn't allow black people, and so they kept litigating anyway. And they won on a technicality, but in the process, Lorraine is a little girl. She was 7 or 8 years old, had a brick thrown at her head and was spat on and all, and that really is sort of the foundation of A Raisin in the Sun. But one of the things she said was that, you know, okay, so that case was fine and we won, but Chicago is still as segregated as it was in 1940. It's one thing she said in 1960. And so I think, so she was much more kind of radical and militant than NAACP was at the time period in which she was doing her activism.
First of all, thank you for being here. And I wanted to know, this is a question about her personal life. Was her family aware of her sexuality, and were they accepting of it?
That's a very hard question. I don't know. She was not out like to her family. So there's, and actually she maintained, she was married from 53 to 64, but that relationship with actually ended around 1957, but people did not know. So she continued to sort of have partial domestic residence with her husband. Her husband knew. But she really, he did function as a kind of protection. So it was complicated because she was a member of the Daughters of Bilitis, which was one of the first lesbian organizations in the country, but was not really out. I spoke recently, just a couple of days ago, with a man who was involved romantically with one of her nephews, and he suggested that her nephew was unaware, which makes me think that her family didn't know. And there are several, Louis Burnham's wife, Margaret Burnham, who is still alive, I think is 100 years old or close to that, says that they didn't know. So it does seem as though her worlds were very separate. And, you know, I don't know whether they would have been accepting. I think, you know, given that this was a time period where, you know, there were raids on gay and lesbian clubs, that the organizations were illegal, that even if they had been accepting, it would have been, there certainly probably would have been efforts to sort of discourage her from being public about it. What I think is interesting is that she was so close to James Baldwin, who was out pretty publicly. So it's not as though there weren't, you know, people around her who were out. But yeah, so it's hard to answer.
Being as Lorraine came through around the early 40s, 50s, racial integration, things that, you know, went on. Did she ever come under the scrutiny of the FBI or things of that sort?
Yes.
And, you know, to be, okay, let's put her on a list that, you know, she can be dangerous to the country.
Yes. So it's a great, thank you for asking that question. Yes. So she is under FBI surveillance actually long before she becomes famous, because Paul Robeson has had his passport removed for his leftist activism, his passport taken away. So she goes to Uruguay as his representative for an international peace conference, which is a leftist peace conference that the United States government has declared illegal. and many governments in Latin America declared illegal. So she gets a passport under a false pretense. She says that she's going to travel Europe for the summer, and instead she goes to this conference in Uruguay. And when she returns, her passport is revoked, and she comes under FBI surveillance. And so there's really quite copious notes following her. And I think it's interesting that it happens before she becomes well-known. And then when she writes A Raisin in the Sun, FBI agents actually go to see it to try and assess whether there's, like, communist or socialist content. And they say, oh, no, no, it's okay. There's nothing, you know, incendiary in the play. And so you can actually read the notes. Some of them are still redacted, but they're pretty easily accessible. They're interesting. But so initially they say, okay, the play is okay. But then they also say, as she becomes really popular really quickly, they say, we need to be careful about our surveillance of her because it's going to upset people, and particularly upset black people, that we're watching her so closely. So the FBI actually pulls back some of its kind of watching of her because they're worried that her popularity will have a negative impact upon them if it becomes apparent how much she's under surveillance. Yeah, that's a great question. One of the things I think, just as an aside, that I think is really interesting, though, just comparing the FBI notes on her versus James Baldwin, the FBI has no idea about her sexuality. But they know about, and they, when they are trying to figure out why she's not always living in the same housing with her husband, and he's like, well, you know, she needs to be quiet to write. And they're like, okay. Okay, so. So it's kind of entertaining.
Thank you very much for being here tonight. Thanks. I learned a lot already. I just want to ask a question. Paul Robeson, you look at his history, I thought he was a great American, mm-hmm. one of our greatest Americans.
Yeah.
Not only a talented athlete, but a gifted orator,
singer,
just unbelievable.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the question I want to ask, did she write commentaries on the treatment of her mentor, Paul Robeson? Because of the fact that in 1947, there was that terrible incident in Peekskill, New York,
yes.
where both he and Pete Seeger almost were hanged. They were going after him. Just some thoughts on her commentaries on how America treated Paul Robeson.
Yes. I just have to say, these questions are so amazing because it's like all the stuff that's in the book. Yeah. So, yes, and she often spoke at rallies in support of Robeson, particularly because, you know, the loss of his livelihood, once he couldn't travel, it made it very difficult for him to perform. But I also write about the event in Peekskill in light of the fact that she bought a home up in Croton on Hudson, which was close by, and sort of thinking about the decision. It was several years later, but that, you know, the decision to buy a summer cottage up there, notwithstanding the fact what happened to Robeson. But yeah, she wrote a lot about what happened to him and about his significance. And one of the things that was so moving for me in the context of her funeral program is to hear his reflections on her and the kind of and he sang at her funeral. But that the person who he identified as a kind of political and artistic descendant actually eulogizing her to a certain extent, you know, that and the kind of, you know, the clear heartbreak of that reality because he had poured so much into her as a figure. But yes, she wrote, and there I quote them pretty extensively in the book, things that she said about Robeson, yeah.
Thank you for coming. Thoroughly enjoyable.
Paul Robeson, have you been in touch with the Paul Robeson Museum here in Philadelphia at all?
No.
Oh, you really ought to. Should. It's open for business.
Yes.
Yeah. Out there at 49th and Chestnut, I think
mm-hmm.
it is. Yeah. Walnut, yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I wondered, did her career suffer because, or was she blacklisted in any way? Her other works, because the Raising the Sun is the only one of her works that I'm really familiar with. Thank mm-hmm. you.
No, she wasn't. So, I mean, part of that is part of what's fascinating. I mean, that she's under surveillance, but the assessment is that A Raisin in the Sun is not politically incendiary, and it becomes, and not only was she not blacklisted, but one of the things that's really interesting is that even though her politics were well known, she was enlisted at various moments to work with the State Department when the Africa Airlift, when the Kennedy administration brought students from Africa as part of their Cold War policy to the United States. Fascinatingly, she, as well as Malcolm X, served as guides to the United States. And I think it really was actually an effort on the part of the government to provide interactions that these young African students thought would be meaningful with people who they admired, who were African American. And so what I think is interesting is that she's not blacklisted, and she actually also continues to speak very explicitly about her politics. There's the famous 1963 meeting with Robert F. Kennedy in the apartment in Central Park, where really the meeting is called. It's her, James Baldwin, Harry Belafonte, Martin Luther King Jr.'s attorney, some various other activists who are brought because the administration really does want them to encourage black people, particularly in my hometown of Birmingham, Alabama, to kind of relax because it's not good politics. They want to get the sort of black celebrities to quell them. And in fact, something very different happens. And Lorraine Hansberry is the leader of the discussion, and she says, essentially, Lena Horne is there also, and says, essentially, not only are we not going to tell activists in Birmingham to calm down, but we want a moral commitment from you on behalf of civil rights, right? And to take a different kind of position. And RFK is really kind of disappointed after the meeting. He sees it as a failure. But actually, almost immediately after that, the language that JFK uses around civil rights begins to change, and he starts to talk about having a moral commitment to civil rights. And so, So it is interesting. I mean, I think it is the intersection of, Brown v. Board of Education, independence movements in Africa, like the kind of shifting political landscape that makes someone like her, instead of sort of being pushed to the side, actually embraced. The subsequent plays don't get as much attention, partially because they are reviewed more harshly. I think that they are actually quite good, but they are treated, they're not as widely embraced. And then she dies so young.
Professor Perry, it's a comment. There may be a question in here
yes.
somewhere, or something
mm-hmm.
that you could riff on. But one of the things that really struck me in the readings was how kind of rich was her family background. As you were reading, I heard references to several uncles who it
yeah.
sounded like were academics,
mm-hmm.
if I heard that correctly. The father, the real estate thing, going to Mexico. I mean, even though you were describing her own academic journey as kind of fitful and maybe
yes.
didn't really, take wing, it sounded like she was steeped in an environment early on that maybe was a nurturer of the creativity that came subsequently. At least it sounded that way to me.
Yes, absolutely. So what's interesting is that, I mean, she's situated in this really distinct way. So she is from a family that has, more education than the vast majority of Americans in that period. Both parents college educated. Her one uncle Leo was a professor at Howard. There are other members of her family, though, extended family, who are college educated. Her uncle Leo brings a lot of kind of artisan intellectuals into view. She's mentored by the upstairs neighbor, who is an activist and a writer named Ray Hansborough, not related, but
So she has this nurturing, this intellectually nurturing environment. She is a voracious reader as a child. She also talks about being someone who experienced a Jim Crow education. So, for example, she had a lot of anxiety about money because she couldn't count very well. Right? And she says that, you know, she really was not good at making change. And she says that was a consequence of the kind of inferior education that black students were resigned to in Chicago public schools. And so so she had this experience where she, every part of her life, on the one hand, is in, you know, deeply segregated, underserved, far south side Chicago, and also this kind of rarefied intellectual striving community. And I actually think that intersection gave her a lot of insight and also is part of why she became someone with the kind of political commitments that she had.
Dr. Perry, you spoke of earlier, there was a question as to whether her family accepted her, but in reading like her letter she sent to one of the first lesbian magazines anonymously and her letters that she later on would write on her own, there seemed to be somewhat of a tension between herself, within herself, mm-hmm. about her identity. There seems to be somewhat of a tension between what I do and what I identify as, and mm-hmm. could you speak to that?
Yeah, so one of the things I think is interesting, like, so sort of like the sequence of her sort of coming out to herself is interesting. I mean, she ultimately, okay, so I'll sort of answer by not answering, but then I'll answer. I mean, one of the things I think is really interesting is like, so there's a chapter that's on her and James Baldwin and Nina Simone, and it's called The Trinity, and it's about their friendship. And what I think is really interesting is, so Baldwin is known as a gay writer, but Baldwin did not identify, right? He talked about if you fall in love with a boy, you fall in love with a boy, right? He had a very fluid sense of his own sexuality. Hansberry identified as a lesbian. Like she said, I am a lesbian. She said, I am a homosexual. These are phrases that she used in her writing. So she had a very explicit identity, and she would talk sometimes about how she loved it and she hated it, right? And then Nina Simone is someone who really struggled emotionally, mightily over her attraction to women. So here's these three kind of iconic friends who have very different relationships to having, you know, what we call now on the spectrum of queer sexuality. So all that to say, she became very clear about her identity, but she also is very clear, and she said this in some of her letters, that she couldn't become sort of a face of any organizing. And part of that certainly has to do with the time period, but I think part of it also has to do with her politics. Like she had this world, you know, her world on the sort of in the village of like kind of middle to upper middle class lesbians she was the only black person. I mean, there was a couple of black women around. Like it was a very kind of apolitical social scene. And then she has like these different activists, like her worlds didn't come together. And so she, I think, you know, all of that is part of also why she felt really lonely. And some of the grappling also, I think, had to do with sort of the way the pieces didn't fit together. And that's also, I think, part of why her friendship with Baldwin was so precious. And Nina Simone, too.
Could you talk a little bit about the time period when she wrote A Raisin in the Sun and what was going on for her and kind of anything around that time period?
Yeah, so part of what happened is she was working for Freedom, and then she left working for Freedom, and she was writing for several kind of leftist publications and worked at camps and things like that. And then her husband, who was also an activist but a songwriter, had a song that became a hit called Cindy O Cindy that was kind of like, it was in a period called the Calypso craze, and so people were making like sort of kind of pseudo Calypso music. And it was just, so he had a hit song, so he had a lot of money all of a sudden. And so she was able to devote herself full time to writing. And so it was interesting because there was a period where their relationship was kind of falling apart, but he was also, he remained her best friend really until her dying day, and really encouraged her as a writer. And she would, like, you know, she'd write stuff and she'd get frustrated and throw it away, and then he would take the pieces of paper out of the trash can and smooth them out and make her look at them again. And so, you know, Raising the Sun is really the product of her having time to devote to writing. And one of the things that I say in the book is that what's so unusual about her story for a woman artist is that, you know, the conventional story is that it is, you know, women facilitate, particularly in the 50s, you know, when they're male genius. And in Lorraine's case, it was a man who facilitated her genius, both financially supporting and supporting her work, you know, and that it's remarkable, but it's also part of why we have her work, is that there was someone there who facilitated her doing, writing this extraordinary play. Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org.